So today I'm going to switch focus, and instead of the thermal history, I'll start talking about the physics of the very early universe and inflation. First, would anyone like to ask a question before I leave the thermal history behind on anything from the last few lectures? All right. So in that case, for the last I guess five lectures, I'll be talking about the physics of inflation. I want to start by giving a little introduction to motivate the model that we're going to write down. So inflation is sometimes said to solve the horizon problem. Which historically is the statement that the CMB is nearly isothermal. I'll unpack this in a minute. Nearly isothermal, even though it's causally disconnected. To unpack what that means, isothermal just means that when we observe the CMB temperature at different parts of the sky, even parts of the sky that are far separated from each other, we see nearly the same temperature to one part in around 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 5. Causally disconnected is explained by the following space-time diagram. I'm going to use conformal time instead of proper time, since the diagram is a little easier to interpret that way. Actually, let me put it over here. Here's x. Conformal time tau. So if we're here at a equals 1, and this is our past light cone, in conformal time, the past light cone just goes at 45-degree angle, since dx over d tau equals 1. And then we're looking back to, say, here's a equals 0. Then the CMB is formed at very early. When we observe the CMB, we're basically observing a snapshot of the thermal state of the universe when the scale factor is around 10 to the minus 3. If I'm looking at a little piece of the CMB surface, and then I ask, how large was its past light cone at the time that it was formed? Then I get something pretty small. I get something which is around 1% of the total size of our past light cone today. So what that means is that if I observe different points of the CMB surface, which are separated by more than about a degree, then they've never been in causal contact. Their past light cones don't overlap. So how did the CMB surface reach thermal equilibrium if it consists of different causally disconnected pieces of angular size about a degree? With the horizon problem stated in this way, which is kind of the older, more historical way, I'll present the modern way in a minute. One might speculate that our radiation-dominated universe is preceded by some new phase. With the property that the past conformal time is infinite, or at least larger than our conformal horizon today. There's some mechanism for bringing different points of the CMB surface into causal contact at some early time. You showed in a tutorial that the condition for past conformal time being infinite Is the W must be less than or equal to minus 1/3? Based on the information that's on the board so far, we might speculate that our usual radiation-dominated early universe is preceded by some new phase. And the only thing we can really say about it at this point is that its equation of state should be less than or equal to minus 1/3. Now I'm just going to talk about the simplest model of inflation, which is single field slow roll inflation. Let me say that so single field slow roll inflation is a model for this new phase, in which is really simple. The only fields that are important, or at least that contribute significantly to the stress energy, are the metric g mu nu and a scalar field phi called the inflaton. With the following action. So the first two terms are really natural. The first term is the usual action for GR, the Einstein-Hilbert action. The second term is the simplest kinetic term that you can write down for a scalar field in the on a curved background, looks like this. With my sign convention for the metric, with one minus and three pluses, the sign here is a minus. And so this kinetic term is sometimes called, if the kinetic term looks like this, it's sometimes called a minimally coupled scalar field, meaning that the kinetic term is the simplest thing that it could be and still give the usual kinetic term for a scalar in the case where the space-time is Minkowski. Sometimes you'll encounter more complicated possibilities that also have the same Minkowski limit. And then there's just one more ingredient, which is a potential V of phi. And this potential is sort of a free parameter or a free function in the theory. For inflation to work, and this is something that I'll slowly unpack over the next few lectures, just to give a sense for what kind of potential is required. Let me mention in advance that the potential should look something like this. So the potential should be large, meaning just that the absolute energy scale V is pretty large. It should also be pretty flat. To quantify that a little bit better, the energy scale, or the energy density V to the 1/4, should be somewhere between, let's say, a TeV and something around 10 to the 15 GeV. The energy scale of inflation should be somewhere in this very large range to be consistent with the observations. The more substantial constraint is a flatness constraint, which says that V prime over V and V double prime over V, or the first and second derivatives of log V, should be small in Planck units. So, I haven't really explained why yet, but these three conditions should be satisfied for inflation to to be consistent with all of the observations. If these conditions are satisfied, then we'll show that the equation of state is minus one plus a small correction. So when inflation was first proposed, this was more or less the only problem that it was really intended to solve. But somewhat miraculously, it solves a much harder problem, which I'll call the modern horizon problem. So I'm not sure, if I'd been around and doing cosmology at the time inflation was proposed, I'm not sure that I would have been convinced by this picture. Like, it seems like pretty speculative evidence. But nowadays we have a lot more data, and we can say a lot more about the early universe than the causal structure shown in this picture. We know a lot about the initial conditions. So the initial conditions of the universe or the statistics of the initial perturbations are constrained really precisely by modern CMB data. And so let me just try to write down the constraints. So one thing that is known is that the metric takes this form at very early times. So this is what's called the adiabatic mode. One very important thing to mention is that so far I've been neglecting spatial perturbations in all fields in sight, the metric, stress energy, and so on. And the inflation is the only part of the course where I'll start talking about the perturbations. So what I've written down here is metric with spatial perturbations. It looks like the usual FRW metric, but multiplied by this spatial perturbation, where zeta of x is small. The numerical values of zeta are of order 10 to the minus 5 or so. So the content of this equation is that most components of the metric are unperturbed, like there are no space-time perturbations or off-diagonal spatial perturbations. And the function zeta is a function of x but not t. This type of perturbation in the metric is called an adiabatic perturbation. So there's actually a lot of content in this form for the perturbations. The statistics of the field zeta are also really well understood. So zeta, by the way, is called the adiabatic curvature. Another thing that's known about zeta is that it's a Gaussian random field. For which I'll give the following operational definition, that each Fourier mode zeta of k is an independent Gaussian random variable. So if you wanted to make a computer simulation of zeta in our universe, what you could do is, for technical convenience, impose periodic boundary conditions, so surround our Hubble volume with a large bounding box. And then for each Fourier mode k in the box, draw an independent Gaussian random number, and then take the Fourier transform to go to real space. As far as we can tell with CMB data, and this has been tested to something like 0.1%, that would be a perfect simulation of the initial conditions of our universe. And then statement number three is a statement about how the a Gaussian random variable has one parameter, namely its variance, is how the variance of the of zeta of k depends on the scale k. And that's this two-point function. This is so this is known to be a power law. With two parameters, there's an amplitude parameter which is denoted delta zeta squared. The 2 pi squared here is just a convention, which is measured to about 1%. I like to write down the CMB constraints just to emphasize how well things are measured. And then this coefficient epsilon is different from 0 at around 7 sigma. Okay. I won't really interpret this power law except to give sort of the following like hand-waving explanation of what it means. The statistics of the random field zeta are nearly scale invariant in the sense that if I have a realization of zeta in some volume, and then I zoom in on part of the volume and blow it up, magnify it by a factor of 2, then if epsilon were 0, what that would mean is that the statistics of that magnified volume are indistinguishable from the original volume. The field is statistically scale invariant. If epsilon is a little bit negative, what that means is that as you zoom in, you get a slightly smaller field amplitude by a factor of, if you zoom in by a factor of 2, of 2 to the epsilon over 2. So the modern horizon problem is a much sharper statement. One thing that comes out of it is that to get an initial perturbation with the required statistical properties, the realization of zeta in one causal region over here the statistics of zeta in this causal region depend on the realization of zeta in this causal region. So that's a much stronger sense in which the different causally disconnected parts of the last scattering surface know about each other. Like the random fluctuations in one part are statistically dependent in the random fluctuations in another part. Yes?
Sorry, I can't quite see it. The two-point function, is that a zeta and zeta star?
Yes.
Okay, and then the k is raised to the power of negative 3. What is that?
This is k to the negative 3 plus epsilon.
Okay,
so just the power law, which is slightly different from k to the minus 3. K to the minus 3 would be the scale invariant case. If we're trying to solve the old horizon problem, then we can now add all these constraints, and we can ask whether a given theory, whether it's possible to do a calculation in that theory that reproduces all of these observations. That does turn out to be the case for single field slow roll inflation. And in fact, we'll calculate like the two-point function a bit later. So I think it's kind of miraculous that such a simple theory can give rise to these initial conditions, which look kind of mysterious without a theoretical framework. In the next few lectures, we'll sort of slowly unpack how this happens. One comment that I want to make in advance that I think is really fun is this comment on the on Gaussian randomness. So I'm going to claim that, roughly speaking, there are two ways that you can get Gaussian random quantities in nature. One is via the central limit theorem. If you have a bunch of if you're adding up a bunch of uncorrelated contributions. That's what usually happens in statistical mechanics. Like the velocity of an air molecule in this room is a Gaussian random number because it's the sum of a bunch of random thermal kicks. The other way that Gaussian randomness is ubiquitous in nature arises because quantum mechanics, in the presence of small interactions, tends to produce Gaussian randomness. For example, the ground state wave function of a harmonic oscillator is Gaussian in both real and position space, where I think the exponent is something like m omega squared x over 2, if I remember correctly. And so if I have a collection of harmonic oscillators in their ground state, and I randomly sample their, randomly measure their positions, then I'll get a Gaussian probability distribution. And that's also true in quantum field theories, where interactions are small, perturbative quantum field theories. In QFT, you're modeling a random field as each mode of a random field as a harmonic oscillator. In inflation, the Gaussian randomness comes out, even though you didn't put it in, via quantum mechanical production mechanism. Yes.
Okay, so I have a few questions. One of them is, it's not entirely clear to me what you mean by realization of zeta.
Let me comment that cosmology is kind of by nature a statistical theory in the sense that we can't predict the locations of individual galaxies in the universe, say, or individual features in the CMB. We just predict their probability of occurrence. We could say the probability of a given CMB realization is a certain value, or maybe give some procedure for randomly simulating a CMB realization. So in a statistical theory, the best description you can hope to give of the initial conditions of our universe is a statement about their probability distribution, or equivalently, like a computational process for producing them. And so you can imagine what the statement means is that if you want to simulate the universe on a computer, you start by generating perturbations of this type, a Gaussian random field. All the information that you would need is on the board. The middle bullet point says that you can simulate the field zeta in Fourier space by independently generating a Gaussian random number for each k. The statement about the two-point function says what variance you should use for each k. And then the first equation tells you how to take that random field and write down a perturbed metric. Then if you just evolve from there with classical physics, like GR plus the equations of motion for the plasma that tells you how the electrons and protons and dark matter particles respond to the metric, as far as we know, that process for simulating the universe is completely consistent with all of our observations.
So the modern horizon problem would be that the initial conditions in one region of spacetime are correlated to initial conditions in disconnected region.
Yeah, I didn't really show that, but you can show that that is true given these statements, the Gaussian random field and the two-point function, and this form of the two-point function.
Okay.
One way of saying it is that there's just correlations on all scales, so that the conditional probability distribution of zeta in any subvolume depends on the realization of zeta at arbitrarily long distances.
Mm-hmm. Another question: these initial conditions, can you give us an order of magnitude for the time of the Big Bang that these are expected to be true?
For the what? Sorry, I just missed that.
In order of magnitude for the time after the Big Bang, how do we expect this to be true? Are we talking about a couple milliseconds after the Big Bang? Are we talking about microseconds after the Big Bang. So what are these initial conditions we have?
Oh, right. Yeah, I suppose it depends on the energy scale of inflation, which could be anywhere from like a TeV to 10 to the 15 GeV. A useful rule of thumb is that during the radiation-dominated phase, the temperature goes as 1 over the scale factor, which is something like. So the temperature is around an MeV at 1 second. And then during radiation domination, A goes as T to the 1/2. So there's a minus 1/2 here. So let's see. So then T goes as temperature to the minus 2. So a temperature of a TeV, which is the lowest possible energy scale, would be around 10 to the minus 12 seconds.
And since we are here, these smallness and flatness conditions are for inflation initially or for inflation like for the upper part of the potential?
Oh yeah, right. So they apply. Yeah, I didn't really. Yes, I didn't really explain this yet. But there's a sort of a. Throughout most of inflation, the inflaton will be in the flat part of the potential, and it's okay at the end of inflation if it rolls down into a region where these flatness conditions are not satisfied.
One last question. You said that this new phase would have infinite conformal past. But doesn't our universe have a finite conformal past?
Yeah, it depends on when you start the clock. If you start the clock in the hot Big Bang, when the universe is radiation dominated, and the contents of the universe are a thermal plasma, then the conformal time is finite because the equation of state is positive 1/3, which is larger than this threshold value. In inflation, that state of the universe, the thermal hot Big Bang, is conjectured to be the result of this inflaton, these inflaton particles decaying into radiation. And so if you go back before that decay happened, then you'll end up in an epoch where the stress energy of the universe is dominated by the potential energy of a field and a flat potential. And then you can show, I'll show this later today, that the equation of state is close to minus 1. The past conformal time becomes infinite. And any 2 points, if you go back far enough, are in causal contact.
This is really surprising because, like the picture I usually had in my mind was that we have the Big Bang, the universe starts expanding, and then we have inflation. So I would expect it to have a finite past, but
Yeah, in inflation, yeah, if this potential stays flat forever, then both the total conformal time in the past and also the total proper time in the past are infinite. Yeah, that finiteness is really just sort of an artifact of the radiation, the assumption of radiation domination at early times. So that's my introduction, where I mostly just wrote down a bunch of things that I didn't really show. And then in the rest of the class, I'm going to be showing that all of these things are true, like the statement that the equation of state is close to minus 1, and that that fluctuations are quantum mechanically produced. They give this 2-point function. So now, after that qualitative introduction, I'm going to start working out the physics. And so the first thing to do is, let me say that getting from the action, sorry, since there were so many questions, let me. Before I start doing calculations, let me ask if there are any more questions about this picture. Okay. Yes.
So why is the two-point function scale invariant?
Oh yes, it's famously observed to not quite be scale invariant. If epsilon were zero, then it would be scale invariant. Are you asking why? I sort of gave two definitions of scale invariance, and then I swept the equivalence under the rug. I didn't really show that. So one definition of scale invariance is just that you have a k to the minus 3 power law in the two-point function. The other definition is the more intuitive statement that if I have a random realization of the field in a volume, and then I magnify a subvolume up to the size of the original volume, then the result is statistically indistinguishable from the original. And I didn't actually show that these were equivalent. So maybe that's what you're asking, is why are those two statements equivalent? Yeah, right. So it just has to do with like one way to show that is if I have in real space some random field and I magnify it, I apply an operation of this type where a is a constant. Then in Fourier space. Let me just outline how you would show that. Just to demonstrate that it's a calculation that you can do. Actually, to make the notation better, let me define this with primes. This was a factor of a cubed, I think. Yeah, I'm not doing a good job of. Yeah, maybe the simpler way of saying it is actually that it follows from dimensional analysis. So if this. Yeah, you can show it by just carefully working out the transformation law for the two-point correlation function under a magnification operation. That's sort of a brute force approach. You can show that if the two-point function has this form and you magnify the field, that you get the same thing in the new coordinate system. But it takes a little calculation. I think a more conceptual way to see it is just by dimensional analysis. Since if zeta is dimensionless, as it must be to appear in an exp, then zeta of k has units of volume because it's defined this way with an integral of d3x. And so what I have, let me write that as saying that it has units of length cubed. So then what I have on the left-hand side here has units of length to the sixth. The k to the minus 3 has units of length cubed. And the delta function also has units of length cubed. Generally speaking, a delta function has the units of its inverse argument. And so what that means is that if this exponent is k to the minus 3, then and only then is this prefactor dimensionless, has units L to the zero. Meaning that it's independent of the units of length that are being used. And so you should get the same value if you magnify the field, which is the same thing as the same numerical value, which is the same thing as using a different ruler to measure lengths. Yeah, that's kind of a conceptual argument for why k to the minus 3 corresponds to the case of a dimensionless prefactor and consequently scale invariance. The observation that the exponent here is slightly different from minus 3 Dates back to 2005, I believe, from the 3-year WMAP results. And is a very, I mean, I think that was when it crossed roughly 3 sigma. Now it's more like 7 sigma. It's really one of the big milestones of observational cosmology in the last 20 years or so. That was a really good question.
So, yeah, if I may just like to say that I understand it correctly. So assuming that this phase of the universe happened, then there was never a Big Bang. The universe existed like from arbitrarily early times.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a really good comment. Let me move down this picture.
At some point, there was this transition to radiation that created the illusion that the Big Bang happened.
Sorry, say that again.
At some point, there was a phase transition to radiation domination.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So if you don't have inflation, then your picture is that the universe ends in a big bang. Whereas if the universe starts here, then as you run the clock backward, one thing that happens is the temperature gets higher and higher. And then the other thing that happens is that you eventually get a singularity in that some components of the metric go to zero. If inflation is the right picture, then somewhere very close to A equals zero, there's a phase transition when the temperature is very high. Some new physics takes over, which is sort of unsurprising if you think of the universe as like a big particle accelerator, whereas you go backwards in time, you're going to higher and higher energies. Then eventually you expect to see new physics. There's some temperature where you go from a very hot universe with a very small scale factor, where you go from an inflationary phase, where the universe is really simple. The stress energy is just dominated by a scalar field on a flat potential. The particles of that scalar field decay to radiation. You get a radiation-dominated universe at a high temperature. This state is sometimes called the hot Big Bang. The term hot Big Bang is sometimes used to describe the universe just after the inflaton decays to radiation, when the temperature is very high. I guess it has to be higher than an MeV or so to not screw up neutrino decoupling and the physics that we talked about before. The hot it's, and so inflation is sort of a theory of how the universe ends up in that hot Big Bang state, which I think on its own is not actually that constraining of a statement. But also ends up with these statistical properties, which are very, very constraining, precise statements that we can try to calculate from a theory. Thanks for all the excellent questions. Would anyone like to ask another question before we move on to doing calculations? So the road of calculations that leads from this action to a quantum mechanical production mechanism with this two-point function is a really long road. There are a lot of steps. I think I can't quite do them all in 4.5 lectures. So there'll be a few points where I just write down the result of a calculation and say how you would do it without going through all the steps. Generally speaking, first there's a bunch of like classical GR calculations to write the action in a more useful way with fewer degrees of freedom, followed by quantization and working out the quantum mechanical production mechanism. I think the quantum mechanics part is kind of more interesting and fun than the classical GR part. So I'll sort of summarize some of the classical GR calculations in the next lecture or two. When I talk about the quantum mechanics, I'll do it sort of more slowly and pedagogically. The GR calculations, if you're familiar with GR, then they really are kind of brute force calculations. So the first thing that I want to do is just write down the equations of motion for the metric and the inflaton. by varying this metric, or varying this action with respect to those fields. For these equations of motion, I want to emphasize that the metric is arbitrary. I'm not assuming that the metric is FRW or anything like that. Since I do want to consider perturbations eventually, and also arbitrary potential V of phi, I'm not assuming a flatness condition. I'll just summarize the result of this calculation. It's kind of a brute force calculation. So the equation of motion for phi looks like this. This is the for a Minkowski metric, this equation of motion would look like this. This is the usual Klein-Gordon equation for a massless scalar, well, for a scalar field and some potential V of phi, just generalized to a curved metric. One little comment here is that when I wrote the action, I chose to write covariant derivatives here instead of partial derivatives. But the two are equivalent. I could have written the action this way. Because the derivatives just act on a scalar quantity with no indices. So the covariant derivative notation was kind of superfluous. But in the phi equation of motion, where I'm writing the covariant Laplacian here, the four Laplacian, the difference is important because the outer covariant derivative acts on an object with an index. So there's a Christoffel symbol term. There's the equation of motion for the metric, which I'll just write this way. This is just Einstein's equation, I remind you that M Planck is 8 pi g to the minus 1/2, around 10 to the 18 GeV. The stress energy after some calculation looks like this. I'll just omit the derivation for reasons of time, but it's very much a brute force calculation, just working out the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion for this action. The next thing I want to do is specialize to the case of where I have rotation and translation symmetry, the same symmetries as the FRW metric. What I really want to do is specialize these equations of motion to the case of a metric that approximately has these symmetries plus some small perturbations. The first step is just specializing to the case where there are no perturbations, the equations of motion for the background that will perturb around. Let me start by commenting that if these symmetries are assumed, then we know that the metric takes an FRW form. That was a statement that we made in the early part of the course, motivating the form of the FRW metric from symmetry assumptions, although we didn't quite prove it. And then the stress energy tensor also has this form. I guess I'm assuming zero spatial curvature. Working out the physics of inflation in the presence of some small spatial curvature is also possible, but the algebra is messier. And then finally, in the presence of these symmetries, the phi field depends on time, but not space. So then if I take these equations of motion and specialize them, then I'll get equations of motion for phi and also the scale factor A. And I'll ask you to do this in tutorial 5, today's tutorial. By the way, today's tutorial is going to be really short since you guys asked so many good questions that I didn't, I won't get a chance to cover everything that I thought I might cover, which is a good thing, of course. So let me write the equations down and then I'll interpret them a little bit. The first equation I'll just come back to in a minute. The equation of motion for the scale factor A is, of course, Friedman's equation. But I need to tell you what the stress energy is. So that follows from specializing this covariant form of T mu nu to the FRW metric. The result can be written as expressions for rho and p. Okay. So to interpret these equations a little bit, let me start with the stress energy. What these equations say is that the stress energy is sourced by two components. There's a kinetic energy that comes from the motion of the inflaton from phi dot, and then a potential energy V of phi. You can see from these expressions that the equation of state, P over rho, is minus one for the potential energy, V of phi. So the potential energy is acting like a cosmological constant, and plus one for the kinetic energy. One half phi dot squared, which is not a value of W that we've seen before, but that's what you get for the potential energy of a scalar field by this calculation. And then to interpret the equation of motion for phi, let me first point out that if in a non-expanding universe, if h was 0, then the equation of motion would just read phi double dot equals minus v prime of phi, which is what you would expect for a single classical degree of freedom on some potential. If I put in this new term, 3h phi dot, then that's just acting like a friction term that slows the field down in proportion to its velocity phi dot. And so this is sometimes called Hubble friction. If the universe is rapidly expanding, then this term can be large. In fact, the flatness can, well, I'll get to that in a moment. Earlier I used the term Hubble friction in a different context to describe the tendency of geodesics in FRW to slow down and converge on the FRW rest frame. Hubble friction is kind of acting as a source of friction on free streaming particles to like drag them into the FRW rest frame. Here we get kind of an analogous Hubble friction term, which is trying to pin the scalar field in place on its potential and not let it roll down. This is kind of a natural place to pause. So even though there are 5 minutes remaining, I think I'll stop here for today. Would anyone like to ask a quick question before we break till the next lecture? In that case, the only problem on the tutorial is going to be to derive these equations of motion by specializing these covariant equations to this metric, which will be pretty fast. I'll see you on Thursday to keep developing the physics of inflation.